You're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag SDRask podcast with Greg Kokel and Amy Hall.
Oh, it's with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. You can top the link.
I'm Amy Hall, by the way.
You're another one of those by the ways. I meet by the ways all over the country. Hi, I'm Bill, by the way. I'm Fred, by the way. I said, man, that's a big family. Now another by the way.
Okay. All right, let's start with a question from Kelly Y. What is the best atheist argument for objective morality that you have heard, and why is it wrong?
Well, it depends, in this case, what you mean by objective morality. And there is only a genuine objective morality, the kind of objective morality that we mean, not the kind that Sam Harris means, where you can look at a goal like human flourishing and say we can have objective means to accomplish human flourishing. That's not objective morality. That's objective pragmatic steps to accomplish a goal. He has not demonstrated why human flourishing is an appropriate objective moral end. Something different, okay? His is just a kind of subjectivism because he's an atheist and, by the way, a determinist. So I don't know how that makes any sense in his system, because morality by nature is something that is chosen, not merely a machine-like reaction to the prior circumstances that govern it, okay? The only actual characterization, actual grounding of objective morality I have ever heard is what's called moral Platonism, okay? And Plato believed that there were ideals in the immaterial realm, all right, of all sorts. I mean, they had ideal chairs and ideal tables and, you know, the perfect characterization. And what we are looking at is just the imperfect manifestations of those things, but they were all representations of the perfect form. Now, in principle, you could have morality. And by the way, that's an objectivist system. These things were outside of the physical realm, and they were mind independent. And just for the record, for people who like to slice and dice this very carefully, the distinction between objective and subjective is whether the thing in view, say the belief or the claim, is mind dependent or mind independent. That chocolate ice cream is delicious being uttered by me is mind dependent. My mind goes away, the deliciousness of chocolate goes away, at least with regards to the statement I'm making. That rape is wrong. If it is wrong, even if I change my mind, it doesn't change the nature of the action itself. Okay, that's objective. It's not mind dependent. Now, in the case of moral Platonism, there may be all of these virtues that are ideals in the ideal realm, so the virtue of justice and the virtue of kindness and all of these things that may be objective forms whether people believe in them or not. Okay, fair enough. That is a way of grounding morality writ large. The problem is that morality for humans entail the notion of obligations. It isn't just that we say as Christians, kindness exists as an abstract value. No, the obligation for us is that we ought to be kind. No, obligations are held between persons, not between objects. The virtue of kindness creates no obligation for me to be kind. All right? The obligation is a result of a command. So if the virtue of kindness, for example, is grounded in God's character, then from that as a grounding or a foundation, God could say, and you ought to be kind as well. Now we have not just morality in a sense in the abstract, but we have grounding for obligations. And morality by its nature, as it functions in the human beings, is obligation. And if it's not obligation, what is it? If we don't have an obligation to do the good things, then what the heck is morality? So that's what the best argument is, in my view, because it's the only argument that could make sense of objective morality, at least writ large.
Because it has to be something outside of us.
It's outside of us, and therefore it's mind independent. Mm-hmm. So even before human beings existed, these forms would have existed, okay? But they don't accomplish the task of making sense of moral obligation, and that is the problem. Mm-hmm. How do we get objective moral obligation? Bill Craig has done some good work on this, clarifying this even for me. So what I'm reflecting is what I got from him. One other point he made is that how is it that these abstract objects in moral Platonism have any bearing on human beings? How is that? But they seem to only have bearing on human beings. And so that's another unique factor that, moral Platonism cannot account for, but Christian theism can. It's the best explanation for the way things are, as I like to say.
Yeah, I was just thinking about William Lane Craig because he wrote about this topic in his book On Guard. Have you read that one? It's kind of a...
it's a popular treatment of his apologetics approach.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's so helpful because he also gives each argument in, you know, he'll give like maps of arguments at the end of each chapter. Mm-hmm. So you can just go through and here are the objections and here's the answers.
Very left brain.
It's very helpful.
But it's clear.
Yes,
it's
very
clear. There's clarity there, yeah. So this is one of the...
He responds to atheistic moral Platonism in that book, and he gives... I think you've hit on everything he said. Number one, he says it's unintelligible, because what does it mean to have justice out there apart from a person, just out there?
Yeah.
And then secondly, he says...
I didn't mention that one, but that's a good one.
Yeah, so then secondly, he says, like you said, it provides no basis for moral duties. And then finally he said, it's fantastically improbable, that's how he puts it, that the evolutionary process would create beings that would just happen to correspond to these abstract objects and be able to comprehend them. And he says that's just impossible.
That's right. But what you'd have to be is a non-materialist also at this point. So if you were a strict evolutionary materialist, what you would have to you couldn't acknowledge the Platonic forms because they're not material, okay? So it would be an unusual atheist who was not a materialist who believed in Platonic forms. And it turns out even those forms are not going to be adequate to the task. And here's the important point, friends, of explaining the moral project as we understand it to be in this world. We have perceptive capabilities. We can see the world and features of the world, in this case, morality. We know that the world is thick with morality. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to find a way to explain that project. How do we make sense of this? And so these different efforts to make sense of it don't make sense of what we actually experience. What makes sense is some form of a theistic answer, where you've got an individual who is the ground of morality, and thus avoiding what some people call the Euthyphro or Euthyphro dilemma. God is the grounding of morality. It is a primitive. We're able to recognize goodness. We have the capability, and then He is the proper authority to elicit commands for us to obey or disobey, and if we and that's what goodness and badness turn out to be, and so it's fully adequate to explain the problem, all aspects of the problem. And this is why I keep going back to this concept. It's the best explanation for mm-hmm. the way things are, because I think this is one of the huge strengths of Christian theism.
So, for a summary of William Lane Craig's response, I did write a post on our website at str.org, and it's called A Response to Atheistic Moral Platonism, and you can see kind of a summary of William Lane Craig's
explanation. Yeah, she was using that as a cheat sheet.
Yes, I was. I admit it. Okay, here's a question from John Michael Workington. How does the impeccability of Christ relate to amoral mistakes? In other words, would teen Jesus ever come home with a C- on his recent math test?
Well, I think that that's... I don't have any reason right now to think that that's not possible. Kids learn their times tables, right? and you learn times tables, kind of going over them. And I don't know if Jesus had times tables, but, you know, they have some method for learning the relationship of these things. And these things are a function of the developing brain giving access to mathematical faculties. We talked about these kinds of things in a prior STR ask, and that's an imperfect process. You know, when you're growing and you're learning these things, it's like asking, well, if Jesus played baseball, would he throw, would every pitch be a strike? Well, by the way, if every pitch was a strike, he'd be a lousy pitcher, because every batter would knock it out of the park because they knew exactly where it was going. Physical capabilities, mental capabilities, and the like are all features of the growth of and maturation of the body. And growing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man is the way it was described with Jesus. And so, yes, he grew in wisdom and he grew in stature and his understanding of things. So I don't see any reasons why he wouldn't. I don't see any problems with him making a mistake in math or something as he's growing mm-hmm. up, just like his handwriting would have to improve over time. That's unrelated to peccability, which is peccability is the ability to sin, essentially. And if Jesus is impeccable, that means he can't sin.
So his faculties obviously are not marred by sin in any way, and that's nothing we've ever experienced. So he has a perfectly working brain, mind, you know, body. But
so he might have got to those times tables faster than you and I.
But he's still limited in that maybe he hadn't learned something yet, or maybe he didn't see something out of the corner of his eye, or maybe, you know, because as a human being, he's limited in his awareness of what's around him, you know.
Writing, I think, is maybe a good illustration people should think of, because that requires a kind of motor skill that is very clear, develops over time as you get better at writing. And I don't see any reason not to think of the other faculties in this similar fashion.
I think about the verse in Luke 2:52, and Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature.
Didn't I just say that?
Did you say the verse? I didn't hear it.
I said that.
Sorry.
Maybe that's where you heard it before.
But here's one other question for you.
All right.
So when
take that.
Kyle's laughing on the other side of the glass. So that's what happens when I'm looking something up when you're talking. So,
Well, see, that's her excuse, right? All right. Okay, I'll accept that. You probably weren't paying attention.
So when our bodies are completely regenerated and we're no longer marred by any sin, can we make mistakes in the new earth?
No math mistake, but no checkbooks to balance. So maybe. I don't know, this is speculative. I haven't really thought about it. When you say make mistakes, can there be, will we always throw perfect pitches or, you know, I don't know.
Do you think we'll still, I mean, this is all speculation, but do you think we'll still have abilities so that maybe I can understand this far in math, but someone else can understand that far in math?
I don't know, maybe, because I think there are different soulish qualities, and some people, I don't see, even in the resurrection, there are going to be variations, you know. Some people are more godly than others, and that godliness holds a great benefit for the age to come, Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy. So there's something like that. Keep in mind, too, that notions of perfection in some cases are conventions. So when I say perfect strike, well, that's a convention that we made up what a perfect strike looks like, you know. And so there are a lot of things that may fall into that category where the conventions of perfection wouldn't even apply in a circumstance mm-hmm. like in the resurrection. But
so having moral perfection is not the same thing as perfection in every ability.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
I mean, when we say things right and wrong, there are two ways to understand that. We could say moral or immoral, or correct or incorrect. And so, you know, I might not be sitting in the correct way for good posture or something like that, which is the case at the moment. But that doesn't mean I'm being bad boy because of the way I'm slouching or something like that. There are two different categories. Mm-hmm. That's called equivocation, where the same word means two different things, and sometimes we need to distinguish to be clear on what we mean when we're talking about a topic.
Rutabagas Are Good asks, what do you make of the, quote, God closed that door sort of thinking? Are there closing doors in the biblical records that have to do with answers to prayers? Sometimes it seems a bit too thin of an answer.
Well, it is in the scripture. I don't know if it's in answer to prayer. I don't know if somebody says, God, please close that door, and then it slams shut. I'm not sure if we're going to find a characterization quite like that. But in the end of 1 Corinthians, let's see if I can find it quickly here. Oh, no.
I'm thinking,
1 Corinthians 16 has an open door, and 2 Corinthians chapter 1 they are both open doors, but one Paul goes through and the other one he doesn't. I think what you have in Romans chapter 1 or 15, and in those two chapters, Paul discusses different aspects of his planned or his desire to go to Rome. And he says, I have not been allowed to so far, but, you know, I'm going to keep pressing on. Until if at last by the will of God I can succeed in coming to you. So there's he sees, you know, in our terminology, there is a closed door, but that doesn't mean he can't keep pushing on it. And if then God sovereignly, and I think that's what he means by the will of God, God sovereignly allows that door to open, then he'll go to Rome, which God did. No, of course, Paul went to Rome in chains, and he never came back, you know, but that was the way God purposed to open that door for Paul. So I don't think that the idea that open doors and closed doors is a somehow thin concept that's not biblically supported. By the way, even if the words open door and closed door weren't in the scripture, as a metaphorically speaking, those would be legitimate ways of describing things we do find in scripture, where the opportunity that we have is made available to us. That's the open door, the end of 1 Corinthians, beginning of 2 Corinthians, two different occasions. And when we are thwarted by some circumstance outside of our control, and that's when I invoke the concept of the sovereignty of God, because God's sovereignty covers all circumstances, even bad circumstances. But this is why James says, if the Lord wills, we will do this or that, go to this city and make that profit. Don't just pretend like you can do whatever you want without being aware that God can intervene at any time. So that's my paraphrase, but I could say that God would close the door at any time. Closed door language isn't in the passage, but clearly that's what James is referring to.
So it's not that you're trying to discern, oh, this is an open door, this is a closed door, therefore I will do this or that. Like, you're not using it as a sign to interpret things.
If the door is closed, the door is closed.
Right, that's what I was
saying.
That means
in the moment, God is not allowing us to go forward in this way. Okay. And I mean, we had a recent event with Stand to Reason where a door is just slammed in our face. Well, okay, we pushed and pushed and pushed, but it looks like for a number of reasons, including legal, this is not what God's allowing for us. We're going in a different direction. So God is sovereignly stopping one approach. So it's not even open for us to decide because the decision mm-hmm. has been made. Okay, so then we got to find some other answer. Open doors, however, do not mean that God is prescribing that choice. And this is why I went to 1 Corinthians chapter, or the end of 1 Corinthians 15, and there is an open door of service. And Paul goes through that, but in 2 Corinthians, there's another open door that he does not go through. So he sees open doors as opportunities that should be assessed. And even if he acknowledges that God has made this opportunity, it doesn't necessarily entail an imperative to do that thing. And that's why open doors should not be read as directives from God, mm-hmm. but merely opportunities that should be judged on other criteria.
So I have one more example of a closed door here. In Acts 16:7, they were trying to go into Bithynia, and the Spirit of Jesus did not permit them.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It does not tell us the modality of that.
Right.
It just says, did he say? Was it circumstantial? There is no clear indication. But clearly, they understood that mm-hmm. this was a closed door that God was responsible for.
Well, I'm closing the door on this podcast because we are out of time.
That isn't an act of God, but a judicious nonetheless.
Well, thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
And thank you, everyone, for your questions. As always, we love hearing from you. We love having a ton of questions to choose from. So send those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.